Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
Bienvenue à tous et à toutes en cette matinée maussade au colloque sur Perspective internationale sur le rapport Bouchard-Taylor. Mon nom est Daniel Weinstock. Je prendrai simplement quelques minutes pour vous accueillir et pour parler un peu de questions de contexte général et aussi de logistique pour la journée et demie qui vient. Tout d'abord, je voudrais dire que cet événement est le fruit d'une collaboration entre trois institutions montréalaises que sont d'abord le groupe de recherche interuniversitaire en philosophie politique, le centre de recherche en éthique de l'Université de Montréal et le centre d'études ethniques des universités montréalaises. Donc, je voudrais reconnaître la contribution de ces trois organismes à l'événement d'aujourd'hui. Donc, nous arrivons presque... C'est étonnant de le dire, le temps passe vite quand on s'amuse. Nous arrivons presque au premier anniversaire du rapport Bouchard-Taylor. Il y a un an, lorsque le rapport s'apprêtait à être publié et qu'on en parlait tous les jours dans les médias, vous vous souvenez de la fameuse fuite qui a eu lieu quelques jours avant la publication du rapport, on ne parlait que de ça, on parlait plus de ça que de hockey, ce qui à Montréal est quelque chose d'assez remarquable. Si vous m'aviez dit qu'un an plus tard, j'aurais été amené en tant que directeur d'un centre de recherche à organiser un colloque sur le rapport Bouchard-Taylor, je vous aurais dit, écoutez, non, on en a déjà beaucoup parler et je ne sais pas si on peut en dire des choses qui n'ont pas déjà été dites. Or, il me semble que dans l'année qui a suivi sa publication, le rapport a connu un sort quand même assez étrange, ayant été au cœur de tous les débats pendant plusieurs mois, avant qu'il ne soit publié. On se rappellera des audiences qui ont traversé le Québec et qui ont été l'objet d'une très grande attention médiatique. Le rapport est tombé vers la fin du printemps. Évidemment, l'été est arrivé. Pendant l'été, les gens ont tendance à laisser tomber toutes leurs préoccupations philosophiques, éthiques et autres pour s'occuper de leur piscine et de leur chalet. L'automne est arrivé et nous avons été accaparés par Barack Obama, Sarah Palin et d'autres. Et ensuite, peut-être un peu moins par Stéphane Dion, Stephen Harper, Jean Charest et Pauline Marois. Et il me semble que dans les mois qui ont suivi donc, le rapport, paradoxalement, alors qu'on en a beaucoup parlé avant qu'il ne soit publié, on en a moins parlé après qu'il soit publié, ce qui est quand même un résultat un peu paradoxal. Évidemment, M. Charest a remporté ses élections avec une majorité. Ses enjeux aujourd'hui avec la crise économique sont sans doute ailleurs. Lorsque l'automne est arrivé et que la profusion de colloques auxquels je m'attendais sur le rapport Bouchard-Taylor n'a pas été aussi profuse, si je peux inventer un mot que je l'aurais pensé, je me suis dit que, ma foi, ce serait intéressant d'organiser un colloque pour qu'un an plus tard, les passions étant peut-être un peu retombées, avec un an de recul, nous puissions regarder ce rapport et faire un peu de bilan sur ce qu'il contribue à notre débat. L'originalité du colloque, s'il en est, c'est que plutôt que de rameuter les mêmes voix et les mêmes personnes qui ont contribué, je dirais presque ad nauseam au débat, et je me compte parmi ce nombre de gens qu'on a beaucoup entendus pendant plusieurs mois autour du rapport, je me suis dit qu'il serait intéressant d'élargir le débat et d'inviter des théoriciens qui se sont penchés sur des questions d'aménagement et d'accommodement culturel et religieux dans d'autres sociétés que le Québec, à lire le rapport, si ce n'était pas déjà fait, et à voir comment leur éclairage, l'éclairage qui provient de leur contexte sociétal peut apporter un éclairage différent au rapport, et comment le rapport pourrait, illuminer ou non la situation de leur pays. Donc, nous avons invité des gens qui viennent du Canada anglais, hein, qui a jusqu'à un certain point été un peu absent de notre débat québécois, pour des raisons sur lesquelles on pourrait s'étendre, des collègues américains, des collègues venus d'Europe, pour réfléchir un peu à voix haute avec nous pendant un jour et demi. Donc, voilà un peu le mandat que je nous confie. Nous sommes un beau groupe. Nous avons organisé les choses. Alors maintenant, parlons un peu de logistique. Avant de parler de logistique, je voudrais signaler la présence, si elle n'a pas déjà été remarquée, d'un des deux auteurs du rapport, Charles Taylor, qui nous fait honneur de sa présence et qui, j'espère, se sentira libre de participer à nos délibérations, à nos discussions. Ayant tant de gens dans la salle dont beaucoup ont des choses à dire, des contributions à apporter, j'ai voulu faire de sorte que les présentations formelles soient ne prennent pas tout le temps qui nous est imparti, donc qu'on ait beaucoup de temps pour les questions. Les présentateurs vont donc partir le bal. Un commentateur sera assigné à chaque séance pour commencer à réfléchir à des questions que nous pourrions débattre ensemble. Et vous serez ensuite invité à participer au débat. Chaque séance aura un modérateur ou une modératrice à qui j'ai donné le mandat de s'assurer que les interventions venant de la salle ne soient pas de nouvelles conférences, mais des remarques succinctes qui permettront à tous d'intervenir s'ils le veulent. Donc, sans plus tarder, je voudrais présenter le premier panel. Nous avons appelé le colloque Perspective internationale sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard et nous avons inclus dans l'international le Canada anglais. Il n'y a aucune intention politique qui est implicite dans ce fait. Simplement, le constat que le débat pendant les mois du rapport Bouchard-Taylor des audiences a été un débat très québécois. Quand j'allais au Canada anglais, même à Toronto, à Ottawa, donc pas très loin, et que je parlais de ce qui se passait ici, j'avais le sentiment que nos concitoyens canadiens anglais n'en avaient qu'une conception assez obscure. J'ai pensé qu'il serait intéressant de commencer par une perspective donc internationale au sens sociologique et non politique du terme, en invitant des collègues du Canada anglais de venir livrer leurs réflexions sur le rapport. Dominique Lédé, my colleague from Université du Québec à Montréal, chair of philosophy department, newly no longer on strike. Congratulations for the resolution of that conflict. We'll be commenting, but the two main presentations will be by Abigail Eisenberg, who is a professor of political science at the University of Victoria, so really far into English Canada, who is about to publish a book with Oxford University Press coming out in August entitled Reasons of Identity. Professor Will Kimlicka, who is the Canada Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's University, who is the author of books too numerous to mention, but most recently Multicultural Odysseys, which looks at issues surrounding multicultural accommodation in a really global context. Will also be presenting, giving a presentation. Dominique Lédé will be leading off the discussion with some comments, and chairing and keeping everybody rigorously to time will be, except me, will be Héloïse Côté, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Centre de Recherche en Éthique de l'Université de Montréal. Alors, sans plus tarder, je cède la parole à nos panélistes.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to come and speak to you. I thought today what I would do is just tell you one thing in the report that I found very helpful and one thing that I found wanting, one thing that I had some misgivings about. And let me start by saying, talking about what I really liked about the report, and I want to put this in the context of reading the report through the eyes of a British Columbian, so from Western Canada. What I thought I would do today, since I was flown all the way across the country, 7.5 hours to a big time zone difference, to reflect on this report that is very much a report of this place, is to see what sort of impact the report had elsewhere in Canada, specifically what kind of impact it had in British Columbia. I would think, for example, that since British Columbia is a very diverse place, like Quebec, like Montreal, Vancouver is a very diverse place, the two cities have pretty much the same percentage of Muslims, 2.7% in Vancouver, about 3% in Montreal. Half the Canadian Sikh population lives in Vancouver. 5% of Vancouver's population, of Greater Vancouver, is Sikh. And, of course, Vancouver is very well known in Canada for having a very large Chinese ethnic minority. 15 to 20% of the greater Vancouver area is Chinese. So I would just think in all of these ways that these organizations would have something to say about, or the newspapers would certainly have something to say about Bouchard-Taylor. So I asked my research assistant, the first thing I said is, give me all the articles from the Vancouver Sun and the Victoria Times Colonist about Bouchard-Taylor for the last year. And I don't want articles that were reprints from the Globe, and I don't want articles that are simply taken off the Canadian Wire Service. I want, like, op-eds. I want, like, commentary. And she came back with nothing. So, she couldn't find anything. There was one or two things, but really there was nothing. It was not discussed. It was not talked about. It was not talked about by the organizations. It was reported. But it was reported mainly by replicating articles from the Globe and Mail and the Montreal Gazette. So I had to try a different tact, and this is my tact. If the events that transpired in Heroville on the eve of the provincial election in 2007 had occurred in Abbotsford or Chilliwack or Duncan, BC, on the eve of a BC provincial election, and a commission had been established in British Columbia, what kind of issues would drive the debate? And how are these issues similar or different from those driving the debate in Quebec? Well, first let me say something about the issues that would probably not drive the debate in BC, but which seem prominent to anybody reading the Bouchard-Taylor report. Number one, kirpans in schools would not scan in BC. It would not make it at all into such a report. Sikhs make up, as I said, 5% of the population in Greater Vancouver, as opposed to 0.1% of the population of Montreal. But the kirpan is a non-issue. It has been allowed in public schools and courtrooms since 1990 in Vancouver. Even after 9/11, there was never any commentary or any conflict at all about kirpan. So it just wouldn't even make it. This isn't to say that there isn't serious racism in British Columbia, because there is, and I think such a report would be about that, but it would not be about the accommodation of the kirpan. Nor do I think would the accommodation of Muslim practices or Jewish practices make it into such a commission in British Columbia. Veiling, sex segregation in swimming pools and driving lessons, prayer rooms. I've never read an article in a BC paper about any of these things. I'm sure human rights commissions deal with them, but they don't make it into the newspapers. They don't make it into the public discussion. Religious symbolism in legislatures and government buildings, absolutely not. 35% of British Columbians, those are on the census, say they do not believe in any religion. And so there is no religious symbolism in any. It wouldn't be the issue. What would be the issue probably, or a similar kind of issue, is symbols of colonialism. So, for example, last year, the BC legislature permanently boarded up murals in the foyer of the legislature that were drawn on the walls in the 1930s, depicting Aboriginal people being converted to Christianity, being sentenced by a white judge, and bare-breasted Aboriginal women carrying baskets. And these were generally viewed as offensive, and the way in which that was resolved was the murals were covered up. With respect to the Sikh community, again, there are issues. There has been requests for a public apology over the infamous Kamagata Maru incident, which was an incident that happened at the turn of the last century, the 19th to 20th century, in which a boat full of Sikhs coming from India were turned back, were not allowed to dock and disembark in Vancouver, and were turned back and sent back to Asia. Some of them died, and it's viewed as a historical injustice in the Sikh community in Vancouver, and so I'm sure that would be there. So now what about the issues that we would find in British Columbia? Well, first of all, our Aeroville bubble is, I would call, a bountiful bubble. Polygamy would certainly be one of the issues that you would find in such a report. BC has a fundamentalist Latter-day Saints community of bountiful. Polygamy and the absence of criminal prosecution of polygamy is a big issue in the province. And the problem, for those of you who don't know that issue, the problem is often debated in relation to child abuse and the forced marriage of underage children, even though the evidence for either of those two kinds of crimes is scant. The second sort of thing that we would find in a British Columbia report, for sure, is a lot of discussion about historical injustice and compensation issues with respect to the Sikh community, insofar as they would view such a commission as being a platform for them. They would bring up those issues. Certainly the Japanese dispossession is still a very live issue in British Columbia, and recently with the Supreme Court decision of CAP, where Japanese interveners were involved. The Japanese fishing fleet was confiscated without public compensation, without any compensation. Japanese lands were confiscated during World War II. Chinese redress would definitely be an issue. You see a trend in these kind of issues. These are all redress issues. And I think that probably if such a report was to occur in British Columbia, even though it would involve discussing Aboriginal issues, I think that it's important that Taylor Bouchard did not, and I understand why they did not, but in British Columbia, there is on the one hand a great deal of racism against Aboriginal people, and on the other hand, a very palpable fear that Indigenous peoples are being categorized as a racial minority and therefore not a founding people. And so that sort of tension probably would get more play in such a hypothetical report had it been done in BC. And finally, of course, there's the racism and problems with respect to the Chinese community in Vancouver. Not only the issue of racism and historical maltreatment, but the issue of linguistic accommodation, which continues to be a defining issue of that community today. So one way in which the Taylor Bouchard report is useful is that it emphasizes that conflicts take on the character that they do because of historical struggles that communities have endured or engaged in, and that help to construct the identity of the community in a way that gives rise to particular challenges. The problem of accommodation, adjustment, and integration cannot really be understood without understanding the anxieties of the majority who live in a place. And those are not just the anxieties of the majority in the sense that only the majority has those anxieties, but they are really the anxieties of the place whose source is the majority group. Minority groups also have those anxieties, and it's the anxieties that characterize the place. I don't know what Quebecers think about that aspect of the report in reflecting about how the report talks about Quebec's anxieties, the anxieties of the French-Canadian majority here. But with respect to British Columbia, and specifically where I live on the coast, it's impossible to walk around without being confronted by the colonial experience of the place. Right next to our legislature is a longhouse. All the ports are still known for who landed there and what happened there. The populations still remember the historical injustice that the fishing, the dispossession of fishing and the fishing controversies remain today. You can't walk the streets of Vancouver without thinking about contact, about the way in which specific groups of people historically settled. And this sort of information is very well known. The anxiety of colonialism is very much part of the BC experience. And I think that this report has really helped me think about why a report done in British Columbia would be different from a one done in Quebec. And I think that in that sense, it offers a useful lesson and a useful way of understanding. Now, I expect that a similarity between a hypothetical BC report and a Taylor-Bouchard report might also be the broad prescription of that both reports would have to resolve cultural conflicts through public forums and citizen avenues rather than to rely on judicial forums and legal solutions. And here's what I think is problematic about the report. Although I think BC would similarly engage in this kind of distinction. That is, the distinction between the citizen route versus the legal route, which is reiterated throughout the report. This contrast is reiterated throughout the Bouchard-Taylor report. It's tied to the very notion of interculturalism, which acts as a fulcrum for the public orientation in Quebec to cultural and religious diversity. It fits into, I think, a more general narrative about democratic citizenship. Now, for British Columbia, the attraction of a citizen-based, dialogical, reciprocal discussion civic forum means of resolving difficult issues would be part of a narrative of a different kind. It would be part of a narrative about the distrust of elites, including politicians and judges, a preference for citizens' assembly, for recall and initiative and referendum, and a considerable antipathy towards the political process, which is sometimes said to characterize the BC population. For Quebec, I would imagine that the attraction of deliberative and community-based solutions is related to the value of self-government. The legal route, that is, as opposed to the citizen route, contains risks for Quebec, not shared by the other provinces, that a resolution to cultural or religious conflict reached in a court may be appealed until eventually the matter is taken out of the province and settled by the Supreme Court of Canada. At the Supreme Court level, cultural and religious conflicts will be resolved using values instantiated in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, including multiculturalism in Section 27, which are not considered the values of the Quebec community, or at least not defined in precisely the same way in Quebec as maybe they would be by the Supreme Court. Given the imposition of the Constitution Act 1982 on Quebec without its consent, I would imagine that efforts to resolve cultural conflicts through civic forums and deliberative means take on a significance in Quebec related to self-government that they don't assume anywhere else in Canada, at least not in any province. The Bouchard-Taylor report recognizes this, at least in its unabridged version. Now, specifically in reference to the Multani case, which is a case repeatedly discussed in the report, and the question of how a community ought to decide whether kirpans should be prohibited or not in public schools, the Bouchard-Taylor report recounts the path this particular conflict has taken. After a decision between the school and Multani's parents to allow him to wear a kirpan, the decision was reversed in light of parental opposition, endorsed by eventually the school board. In the courts, kirpans were allowed by one court, prohibited by the Quebec Court of Appeal, and the matter eventually went to the Supreme Court of Canada, with a judgment there in favor of allowing kirpans. The report notes that there was widespread opposition to this decision in Quebec amongst ethnic minorities and majorities, and that is reiterated throughout the report. The anxiety, the minorities and majorities opposed it. It also notes that since the Supreme Court decision, three requests have been made of a similar sort, two of which were rejected after negotiation with the family, and a third that ended up with a compromise. That is, the student agreed to wear a small amulet around his neck. The report concludes its recounting of the events of Multani in the following way, and here I quote, "As for the handling of adjustment requests, here we can clearly see the advantages of the citizen route over the legal route." Now, there's no doubt that deliberation, negotiation, reciprocity, and interaction, public interaction, are important, if not crucial, to creating democratic community. As the report argues, the importance of interaction is underlined by the need to educate people about pluralism. And what it means by that is to explain to people, to neighbors, why particular practices are important to particular minority groups. But the Bouchard-Taylor report does not simply say that deliberation, dialogue, and public interaction are good for democracy. It draws a strong contrast repeatedly between the citizen route and the legal route. the contrast, I would argue, is overdrawn. It suggests that legal-based decisions are distinct from, indeed disconnected from, even in some ways undermining of, civic and democratic processes. One problem with overdrawing this distinction is that it appears to suggest that those who are opting for legal-based solutions are denying citizen-based solutions by looking to win rather than to compromise, by engaging in rigid processes, I'm using the words of the report, rather than reciprocity. I think it's also important to recognize that legal processes often provide minorities with a forum to explain in processes that depend on transparent procedures and translucent evidence why particular practices are so crucial to their self-understanding. That is, to minority self-understanding. That is, that legal processes are important parts of civic dialogue. And they're important in all sorts of ways. For example, court decisions often force parties to return to the bargaining table. And here I'm certainly thinking of lots of decisions that of the Supreme Court towards Indigenous people, which are framed often in terms of requiring parties to consult. But even winner and loser court decisions require people to return to the bargaining table. The recent case in Montreal of the Sikh boy who was discharged after taking attempted assault with a hairpin is a good example where the court just said, look at enough. He's convicted, but you really have to resolve this within the community. This is not something, these kinds of cases are not ones that the court is going to continue to adjudicate. And if they do, then the school board's going to lose. That, to me, sends a message that negotiation has to continue in the community. In addition, legal processes play an important role in establishing the conditions of democratic equality within political community. And they do this by specifying the matters over which there should be no compromise, or the terms upon which dialogue should take place. The legal route is often used to establish what it is that has to be protected in order for people to participate as equals in the public sphere. So is negotiation, so is the civic forums, and I don't mean to say that civic forums and civic dialogues are unimportant. They are important. But at the same time, we have witnessed in Canada many instances where civic dialogue proceeds without good information, on the basis of prejudice and stereotype rather than evidence, and here I'm thinking of the polygamy issue in British Columbia, and in a way that frames debate so as to exclude the important concerns of some members of the community, and here I'm thinking of the religious arbitration debates in Ontario. Court decisions, in contrast, are crucial aspects, or I want to suggest that court decisions are, or to remind us, court decisions are crucial aspects of democratic and civic processes. Legal decisions and methods of making decisions are sometimes very helpful. They are sometimes not very helpful, and I don't want to suggest that they're always helpful. In fact, sometimes civic forums are helpful, sometimes they're not. Sometimes legal processes are helpful, sometimes they're not. The real question is when are legal processes are helpful and when are citizen forums helpful? Bouchard-Taylor is not helpful in this regard because it draws too harsh a distinction between the legal route and the citizen route and focuses nearly entirely on building up the positive aspects of the citizen route rather than specifying when the legal route should be followed. I'm going to take 2 more minutes. I think a more helpful approach to the problem would be one that offers more specific guidance, which I take it is what many of the school teachers who gave evidence in the report demanded. That is, what they demanded were specific criteria of assessment that both public decision makers and deliberants could use in assessing conflicts over accommodation or adjustment. As the report suggests, abstract values are at best vague guidelines. Their meaning emerges only in the course of how they are applied to resolve actual conflicts. So the question is, what are the criteria which ought to be used to assess conflicts like those over the Kirpans veiling sex segregation, for example, etc. I would suggest that there are three criteria that ought to be added to the list that Taylor Bouchard offers. First of all, I think it's important within either the courts or civic forums that there be established what I would call a jeopardy condition. That is, whether something which is crucial to the self-understanding or religious identity of an individual or group is at stake. What is it that is being jeopardized, and how important is it? Secondly, I would imagine that another important question is what I would call a validation condition, whether the practice in question is validated by members freely or coercively. And thirdly, I would imagine that what everybody wants to know is whether a practice predictably harms anybody and what the costs of instituting safeguards against harm are. These are the sort of criteria that school teachers are looking for. They're criteria useful to both deliberants and judges, and they are a means by which abstract values like interculturalism, freedom of religion, harmonization can be translated into actual concrete decisions and thereby come to have real meaning in a particular political community. Thank you.